May it please the court. My name is Randy Canny, and I represent Mr. Lucero on this appeal, and have actually been representing him in the trial court since 1997. So many of the rights that we associate with a defendant's right to a fair trial, such as the right to cross-examine and confront witnesses, the right to present evidence and present witnesses, or the right to testify or not testify, are at their core really dependent on the fact that a defendant has to be competent to stand trial. That didn't occur here. In order to know that those rights are preserved and that a defendant is competent, it's important that the court and the defense attorneys fulfill their role in seeing that where there is a question as to competency, the issue is properly brought before the court, and the court properly deals with it pursuant to the statute and the law. In this case, the court, Judge Nieto, didn't do what he should have done in this case when the issue was raised. The defense attorneys, Mr. Duran and Mr. Cohen, didn't pursue their role in this case in terms of adequately exploring and presenting the issue of competency to the trial judge. And in fact, as we argue, we're essentially missing in action at the critical point in constructively denied Mr. Lucero the right to counsel at that key, albeit brief, point. And as a result of those two things, Mr. Lucero was tried while he was incompetent.
What's this critical, albeit brief, time that you're referring to?
Well, I think the critical point relating to what the trial judge should have done is that point in the morning of trial, essentially, where Mr. Wymore, co-defendant's counsel, raised the issue. I think that the critical point for defense counsel is obviously much more than that of what they should have done. But that's the point that the judge's obligations really came into the fore, if not before, once the issues had been raised to him. But at that point, an officer of the court who had been in the courtroom with Mr. Lucero and obviously quite familiar with him raised the issue of competency. He stated to the judge that Mr. Lucero was of an infirm mind. He asked for a hearing on the matter. The judge, in essence, summarily rejected that claim.
Is that a preliminary finding of competency under the statute that then is only subject to further action if, at a minimum, if one of the attorneys asks for a hearing?
I'll take that in two steps. Okay. Our first argument would be no, that he didn't actually make a preliminary finding of competency. He certainly didn't phrase it as such. He certainly didn't discuss the role of the statute and the fact that the defense attorneys would have then had, under the statute, 10 days to challenge that in writing. So I think one of the difficulties is his trial was starting that day. So the statute would have had to have somehow been modified, or he should have notified defense counsel, if you disagree with this, I need to know now before we start the process. No, the statute doesn't impose that, but I think we have to read the statute reasonably. If you read the statute basically provides for a process, but if inherent in the statute is the idea that it's generally going to be raised ahead of time so that you have that 10 days to object. So my first answer to your question would be no, I don't think that was a preliminary finding. He didn't categorize it as such. He didn't explain it would then only be subject to further hearing if defense counsel objected to it. He rather rejected it in essence, saying, I don't think you're the right one to deal with this, and I don't have any other concerns.
Didn't he specifically say there is no, even if you're not the right person to raise competency, but I don't see such an issue?
And to the extent, yes, that is what he said. And to the extent that you do treat that as a proper role of the statute, that's where then we get into the interlinking of the role of defense counsel here, where defense counsel took no action.
By that time, defense counsel had gotten a report from a well-known psychiatrist, Dr. Plazak, that said the defendant is competent, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, recognizing the substantial deference given to trial counsel's strategic decisions, with in hand a report from a well-known psychiatrist that the defense had hired, mm-hmm. that said the man's competent, why would a reasonable attorney keep raising competency?
Well, for one reason, A, they never did raise That's one of the problems, is it was never raised. He addressed the issue, but they never raised and never litigated the issue of competency. Why would reasonable defense counsel in their position raise it anyway? The answer even occurs that same day, shortly before, where they're telling the judge, Judge, we need to have our defendant, we need this looked into. He's having auditory and visual hallucinations. That may be a problem during trial. I mean, common sense, no matter what the wide latitude we give to defense counsel of how much deference we're going to give to them, when a defendant is on the morning of trial hallucinating both auditory and visually, that's a grave concern. If you also look at what they didn't do, in other words, their decision would be given some degree of credence if it was done after full investigation. But as we set forth in the section on what they should have done, we point out the significant contemporary evidence that was available to them. Even then, the statements, for example, of Ms. Marquez, the defendant's mother, who felt that he wasn't able to engage in his own defense, that at one point he was mute and even refused to talk to the judge because he was afraid the judge might steal his voice. You look at the other witnesses we found afterwards that were easily available then, fellow inmates.
But you know, I respect that, but doesn't that assume that the lawyer had an obligation to look for lay opinions on his client's competency when he had in hand the report of his own psychiatrist that said the matter's competent?
Yes, it does assume that to some extent, but the report in and of itself is not just saying, hey, this guy's okay, he's competent. The report, the vast majority of the report is this defendant suffered from a severe paranoid schizophrenia. It described all of the symptoms, and it even said in the little point where he opined on the issue of competency, it even said even though he seems able to assist in his own defense, his view of this whole process is intertwined with his view of the conspiracy against him. I think at that point, a reasonable counsel has some duty, and I think we outline that in the cases we cite, a reasonable duty to look further at that issue. I mean, I just think because one expert looked at it doesn't necessarily insulate their conclusions.
And it's not just his expert.
I understand that, but it's still one expert. And that's one of the things we indicate in our memo on why we think we're entitled to a hearing, is we would have been able to present our own criminal defense expert on the point that said their work at that critical point fell below the standard.
And this is slightly off point, but is the record clear if and when Dr. Plazak's report was presented to Judge Nieto?
That's a good question.
The answer is I don't know. Mine is the same.
The answer is I don't know. I know it was close in time in there, but the report was dated the 23rd. I know they're talking about it on the 28th.
Okay.
And I know there was an earlier report, I think, dated the 7th, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
So the first part is we're saying the judge didn't do what he should have done. And the judge, to the extent this was a preliminary finding, his conclusions are essentially based on erroneous points. He based it on two things, in essence, that the defendant seemed to be acting fine in court, and that the defense attorneys had asked that he be appointed as co-counsel in the matter. And I think the trial judge, Judge Offler, when she denied our motion, relied on those as well. As I pointed out in the briefs, Mr. Lucero had never spoken in court up to that point. In weeks of hearings, the judge had never had a chance to hear Mr. Lucero speak. And contrary to him acting rationally, at the time of the initial advisement, Mr. Lucero stood mute. He said nothing in response to repeated questions. And I think the fact that he was appointed as co-counsel is to be accorded little if no weight, because he never acted as co-counsel. And I can say from some experience of dealing with trying to get clients and dealing with difficult situations, sometimes you do things to placate clients that are unrelated to whether the client is able to fulfill that role. So that's pretty much what Judge Nieto relied upon. The defense attorneys, as I've said, fell down on the job in failing to pursue significant
other information that led to questions of his competency. If you look at the lay witnesses, if you look at Ruben Muniz's petition, he knew Mr. Lucero for years and years and was able to even detail the spiral downward of his mental health. Carl Smith was an inmate at this same time who was able to detail his irrational behavior at the time. And I think what's critical here is two of the critical witnesses that we would have called at a hearing were David Wymore, and as we asserted in the motions and in later filings, David Wymore would have opined at our hearing that he thought that Mr. Lucero was both mentally ill and incompetent, and we would have called David Lane, who had represented Mr. Lucero shortly thereafter on the issue of an appeal, and he also would have opined that Mr. Lucero at the time was incompetent. So that's where we get to the third point, that he was tried while incompetent. Even if you reject my claim that the judge didn't do his job and that the defense attorneys didn't do their job, what we've established with later evidence is he was still tried while he was incompetent. So I think these three issues all intertwine, but they can each be dealt with on a separate point. And if you reject the first two, the third still provides grounds for relief. I think I'll reserve my remaining time unless there's other questions on that or the other grounds that we've raised. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Catherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. First, I'd like to note that we shouldn't even get to this issue, the competency issue. I think under the case law and the rules, this was an issue that could have been raised on direct appeal and was not. And so for those reasons, as I've argued in my brief, I don't think this court should address this issue. But in the event that this court decides to, I will address the issues raised with regard to the competency issue because I think the record sufficiently shows that there was insufficient evidence of incompetency for the trial court to have on its own essentially ordered a competency hearing or a competency evaluation. We're not here for a sanity trial. There's no question the defendant was mentally ill, but as the Supreme Court has recognized, mental illness certainly does not equate to incompetence. And there was sufficient evidence in front of the court to conclude, basically, as it did when co-counsel raised the issue, that there was not an issue of competency. First of all, I don't think co-counsel's comments I don't think they can, under the statute, trigger a request for a competency finding. The statute talks about the judge can sua sponte do it, the prosecution can do it, and defense counsel can do it. And there's certainly reasons why those parties would have reason to do it. The court and the prosecutor have an interest in making sure a fair trial occurs, and so they would have a reason to raise it and have essentially standing to raise it. Defense counsel for the defendant would have a reason to raise it because he would be concerned about having his client tried while incompetent. But I don't think there's any basis for co-defense counsel to raise it. I'd also like to note, in the circumstances of this case, co-defense counsel raised it only in response to defense counsel's comments to the court the morning of trial, being concerned that the defendant at times has auditory and hallucinations. And I don't think there was any comments by defense counsel at that time that he was having those at that time. I think he used the words, at times he has these. And defense counsel was simply concerned that letting the court know that this happens and that they didn't want it to happen in front of the jury. And so they assured the court that they would let the court know if something like that was happening. So it was in response to those comments that co-defense counsel, basically said, you know what, I'm concerned about this guy. I'm concerned about his competency. I think you should have a competency evaluation because I'm concerned for the safety of my client. And I think it's pretty clear if you read co-defense counsel's comments in context, he wasn't concerned about the defendant being tried while incompetent. He was concerned with the safety of his client. So basically, not only do I think that co-defense counsel was not the proper person to request it under the statute, but I don't think it was requested based on the co-defendant's observations or concerns about having observed incompetency issues.
And even if co-defense counsel co-defendant's counsel, let's call him that.
Okay.
Doesn't have standing to raise it. Nonetheless, shouldn't the fact that he brings it up throw up a red flag for the trial court to say, hey, I've been working with this gentleman as well as his lawyer trying to get ready for trial, and I have concerns. Isn't that supposed to trigger something in the trial court?
Well, first of all, I don't think he said that. I don't think he said, I've been working. I don't think we have any indication in the record how closely they've been working together, how often he had seen the defendant. So we don't have any information as to what Mr. Wymore's concerns were based on, other than what he stated, which were comments regarding the hallucinations by defense counsel and his concern for his client's safety. So we really don't know what his request was based on. At least there's nothing in the evidence. But even if that request, that generic request without any basis other than safety, would be enough to throw up a red flag, the court did address it. The court basically said, I don't see any issue here. The court had been, and that's where I get into all of the reasons why there was insufficient evidence of incompetency. So we have defense counsel who never raises the issue himself. Clearly, defense counsel has worked. They even stated in the record they've visited numerous times. They've certainly seen the evidence of the mental illness. But as we know, that's not the same thing as incompetency, and they never expressed any concern. Not only that, if you read Dr. Plazak's report, it appears as if defense counsel expressed to Dr. Plazak himself that the defense counsel had no concerns about his competency. So basically, you have a defense counsel who works with him repeatedly, not expressing any concern, even after co-defendant's counsel expressed concern. And so I think, ineffective assistance of counsel claim aside, that's evidence that there's no concern about competency. Then you look at Dr. Plazak's report, which is a clear finding of competency. He couldn't make it any clearer. The examiner is of the opinion that he meets the statutory criteria for competency to proceed. All the proper language is in there.
What's the date of that? I'm sorry, I don't recall that.
Well, that, it's interesting because the date of that report, which was prepared or provided in supplemental record in this case, was April 23rd. But at the April 10th hearing, at which a preliminary report had been issued by Dr. Plazak, the court made reference at that April 10th hearing to Dr. Plazak's finding of competency. So I believe that that finding of competency, the same exact language, because it was quoted, and I mentioned, and I quote that in my brief with record citations, this was in the April 9th report that the court was reviewing at the April 10th hearing.
The April 9th report in the record?
I don't believe so. But I do believe that at the April 10th hearing, the court quoted the language from Dr. Plazak's April 9th report. So it looks like there was an initial report that had some indication of the diagnosis, the schizophrenia, and that kind of thing. And then there was also the comment on competency that was then repeated in the April 23rd report. So, I mean, you look at Dr. Plazak's report, there's just absolutely no question that the defendant is severely mentally ill, but nevertheless competent to proceed. And then you look at the court's findings. The court's made comments at several points during the proceedings that it observed from the defendant's demeanor and the defendant's actions no concerns about competency. And I understand that the defendant didn't speak much during the trial, but the cases talk about demeanor and actions. We don't have any outbursts here. We don't have any bizarre behavior in front of the court. That, you know, the court was able to see defense counsel speaking with their client, and basically the court made a finding based on its observations that there was no concern. The court's certainly entitled to consider that. I'd like to talk a little bit about the affidavit from David Lane, although I do believe that all of the affidavits that were submitted at the post-conviction hearing cannot be considered when deciding whether the trial court should have held a competency hearing, because those all came after. Arguably, those could be considered in determining whether counsel was ineffective in not obtaining that information and then seeking a competency evaluation. But with regard to whether the trial court should have granted one, David Lane was appointed, and this is in the court records, in November of 1988, so well over a year after trial occurred in this case. So his finding, when he's doing the direct appeal in this other 86 case, that the defendant was competent a year later, is simply not helpful. But the people noted in their response to the post-conviction motion that at the 35C hearing in that case, both trial counsel in the other 86 case, and Judge Villano, who presided over the 86 trial, all of which occurred in February of 87, so only a few months before the trial in this case, they both found no issues of competency. Defense counsel specifically said he had no concerns, nor did Judge Villano. And this information was provided in the prosecution's reply to the post-conviction motion in this case. So I think David Lane's affidavit doesn't help at all. In fact, if anything, in response to it, the statements from the prosecution provide further support for the notion that the defendant was not appearing to be incompetent at the time of the trial in this case. And then finally, Dr. Friedman's report basically, I think, is particularly unhelpful in that he only reviewed documents. He never interviewed the defendant, unlike Dr. Plazak, who interviewed him for over 11 and a half hours, reviewed numerous sources, including the mother's comments about her son's mental illness. And despite all of this evidence of mental illness, which apparently was observed by Dr. Plazak and certainly was documented in his diagnosis of schizophrenia, he still found the defendant competent to proceed. Dr. Friedman did not interview the defendant. He did not, as far as we know, he didn't interview Dr. Plazak. And he only considered what appears in Dr. Plazak's report. And certainly Dr. Plazak could not have been expected to have articulated all of his thought processes and all of his, it was a very thorough report as it is. And so I think just simply looking at this report and saying this should have somehow alerted either counsel or the trial court to ask for a competency evaluation is just completely unhelpful and unpersuasive.
However that may be, does it raise at least some issues that should have been resolved by a hearing?
No. I think that basically the trial, all of this information in front of the trial court at that time showed no affirmative indications of incompetency. And if we're going to basically say that the evidence of mental illness was sufficient to invoke the issue of incompetency, then we're going to have an incompetency evaluation every single time a defendant has any sort of history of mental illness. The court saw nothing in front of it. The defense counsel expressed no concerns about it. Co-defense counsel was the only one who expressed concern but provided no basis for what that concern was other than safety of his client. And so basically, under the facts of this case, there was simply nothing before the court, even when the issue was raised, arguably by someone who had no standing to raise it. But even if that's considered properly raised, there simply was not enough for the court to make a finding, or actually, there was enough for the court to make the finding that competency was not an issue. The defendant could have, at that point, if it was concerned about it, asked for a hearing. He didn't. Defense counsel did not ask for a hearing. And that buttresses the belief, apparent belief of defense counsel that competency was not an issue based likely on Dr. Plazak's report and based likely on counsel's own experiences with the defendant. So I think in this case, there simply was nothing before the court that concerned it. The court made that finding that there was no issue here, even though arguably the court didn't have to. No one requested a hearing. And the trial proceeded. And under these circumstances, I think the record supports the trial court and counsel's actions. I'd be happy to discuss this issue or any other issue if you have any further questions. If not, we would simply ask that you affirm the trial court's post-conviction order. Thank you.
I want to address, first of all, the state's argument about the procedural bar. And I think to make it clear, the only way a procedural bar would apply would be just to the issue of whether Judge Nieto erred in his actions with what was before him. But our argument is, first of all, that this issue is intertwined inexorably with both the ineffective assistance issue and with the issue of whether the defendant was tried while he was incompetent. And there's no way to sort of piecemeal these, since it's our position that extra evidence outside of the record is needed to deal with each one of these three issues. I think if an attorney had raised that, there could be a real risk that these other issues then might be deemed procedurally barred as somehow should have been raised as part of this. To the extent that the court deems a procedural bar to at least be possible there, we'd argue and have cited the cases of Morse and Rodriguez that it's not always a hard and fast rule and that the courts are given some leeway there. We also raise the issue of appellate counsel being ineffective if that was a bar. So I don't think the procedural bar is the way to decide this issue. It's too closely tied to the other issues. Even if defense counsel or co-defendant's counsel wasn't the right one to raise the issue was before the court, creating a bona fide doubt and creating the judge's obligation to sua sponte raise the issue. The state argues that Mr. Lane's opinion isn't helpful, but I think you have to take Mr. Lane's opinion with all of the evidence, and that's why a hearing is needed here, because Mr. Lane's opinion is buttressed by evidence before the trial, evidence during the trial, evidence after the trial, by the state hospital's reports. All of these are the kind of things, including Dr. Friedman's report, that lead to the fact that defendant's entitled to a hearing under the standard in Ardolino. If you look at what Ardolino, what was raised there, I would say that what we've presented here, both factually and legally, presents a far stronger case for granting a hearing, both as to each of these issues and the other issues we've raised in the post-conviction motion. So we'd ask the court to reverse the matter and to grant a hearing, or to the extent the court deems it proper, to grant a new trial as to the issue of the competency, to the extent that a hearing at this late date might be impractical on the issue of basically a retroactive competency hearing. So we'd ask the court to reverse, and I'd be glad to answer any other questions.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon, counsel. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.